Well, I think I'll start off with a correction of what Sangragosha just said. Well, maybe it's not a correction, but it's true to say that compassion is a recent interest, but actually... I think it'd be a bit shameful if, as a member of a Buddhist order for 30 years, it was only a recent interest.
Yeah. So I said particular interest.
Yeah, that's right. But it is true that in more recently I have become especially interested in compassion. And in particular, the relationship of compassion to meditation and to mindfulness. And it's as I've become increasingly aware of the importance in meditation, not only of the ability to settle attention on whatever object one is attending to, which is one of the common forms of meditation, is to settle the attention, say, on the breathing or on some other object where one just lets the attention focus. So it could be on flowers, or it could be even contemplating some idea or some truth, such as interconnectedness, in which case the ability to focus attention is really quite important. And the ability to be present with experience rather than just kind of getting lost in ideas about the past and the future and so forth, but the ability to actually be present. And what I've become increasingly aware of in recent years is just how important the dimension of kindliness is in the ability to attend. And particularly stimulating has been some recent work and developments in psychology and psychotherapy to do with neurobiology, neuroscience, and modes of mind. So I'm going to be talking quite a lot about modes of mind. And in particular, there's a distinction to be made between a mode of mind and a mode of attending, which is based in security, based in nurturing, based in kindness, and a mode of attending which is more threat-based, which is where we're attending to the world, but particularly with concern for safety and monitoring the situation for potential dangers. So it's quite easy, for example, in meditation to be practicing attending, being present in the moment, but with a threat-based orientation. So in a way, looking out for what's wrong. And this manifests often as judgmental thinking and self-criticism and so forth. And this is a very common phenomenon which I've observed over the years. In one of my, as Sangragosha said, you know, I've been involved in teaching meditation for many years, and this repeatedly comes up, that in practicing mindful attention, that it's very easy to slip into it becoming quite sort of judgmental and self-critical. So the recent work on modes of mind, particularly coming out of the scientific community, has been very interesting. And then also the practical applications of that in terms of newer therapies, acceptance-based therapies and mindfulness-based therapies, and also more recently compassion-focused therapies and compassionate mind training and such like. So I thought I'd start off by talking a little bit about what compassion is, and then go on to talk a bit more about how to cultivate it. So starting off with what compassion is, I thought I'd begin by speaking about it from a Buddhist point of view. So going back to my early involvement, my early interest in Buddhism, actually going back to the 70s, I remember as a birthday present I was given... in 1977, this was a book by my brother called The Teachings of the Compassionate Buddha. And I was quite surprised by that title. I wasn't quite sure what compassionate meant. But I knew the Buddha was an awakened one, and that he had taught a path of ethics, of meditation, of wisdom, and that... And that, so therefore wisdom was very important. And at that particular time, I was especially interested in developing wisdom. So as a teenager, I was concerned to understand the world more fully. And this had led me to have an interest in meditation and an interest in things Eastern, including the teachings of the Buddha. So this particular present was very appropriate. And as I say, there it was, called The Teachings of the Compassionate Buddha. And that, I hadn't really been aware of the Buddha as a sort of, hadn't thought of the Buddha as being compassionate. But of course, over the years in studying Buddhism, in meditating and so forth, I've come increasingly to see the value and the importance of compassion, and in fact its centrality in the practice of Buddhism. So, for example, in the early teachings of the Buddha, you find quite a lot of emphasis on ethics, which is basically based in kindness and non-harming of self and others. But in a later developed form of Buddhism called Mahayana Buddhism, you find that compassion is almost equated with wisdom. So the very goal of understanding, of wisdom, of seeing things as they really are, is equated with an experience of compassion. And it's as though there's a sort of cognitive dimension which sees the interconnectedness of all living beings, but that is mirrored or goes along with a more emotional realization or an understanding or a change in relationship to other beings in feeling that interconnectedness with others. And that expresses itself in an attitude of kindness, of well-wishing, of friendliness. And the Buddha, maybe just to say a little bit about the Buddha, just in case you're not familiar with who the Buddha is. So the Buddha's original, I suppose let's start with, the Buddha was a teacher who was born in India about 2,500 years ago in northeast India. And the story goes that he was brought up in luxurious conditions, but nonetheless, at some point, realized that that suffering is inherent in human existence. And in particular, he saw, and sometimes the accounts are quite sort of mythicized, he saw an old person, a sick person, and a dead person. And at that point, he became very concerned about the nature of human suffering, particularly old age, sickness, disease, and death. And he realized that these phenomena, this kind of suffering, applied to all human beings. And he was concerned about this and wanted to find some way to alleviate suffering or to understand the nature of suffering. And why are we in this predicament? Why do we find ourselves here subject to old age, disease, and death? And he took up the religious life as it was at that time. He went out as a sort of wandering mendicant, having seen a wandering mendicant who looked quite peaceful, who looked as though he was calm and reasonably happy, sort of serene, and thought, that's the direction, maybe that's the way that I can find the answer to this problem of suffering. So the story goes that he spent 6 years meditating, practicing with various teachers around northeast India, and did very well in terms of understanding their systems and so forth, but nonetheless felt that none of them had really dealt with the problem of suffering adequately. And finally he sat down under the Bodhi tree, the tree of awakening, as it's subsequently been called, and attained awakening. So that's what the word Buddha literally means. It means awakened one. It's a title. So the Buddha's family name was Siddhartha Gautama. And it's only at the point of awakening where he understood the nature of reality, the nature of human experience, and the cause of suffering and the path that can lead from suffering and so forth, that he became known as the Buddha. So This aspect of the Buddha, his awakening, his wisdom, his understanding, is often emphasized And particularly in early Buddhism, this was the quality that was especially noted, was the wisdom of the Buddha, which he expressed in many teachings subsequent to the awakening. And so there are many stories, there's a vast literature actually of dialogues of the Buddha, for example, where he's meeting with all sorts of people, from kings and queens to just ordinary workers, other wanderers and so forth. And there's this huge literature of all these dialogues and discussions of various aspects of teaching and practice and what's the nature of reality and how does one realize it and so forth, which is found in the Buddhist teachings. And the early Buddhists made attempts at certain times to systematize those teachings and to find the essence of the wisdom contained in them. And in that way, particularly the wisdom of the Buddha was emphasized. But later tradition began to feel that this was a slightly one-sided emphasis, because what was missing from all these wisdom teachings, which basically described a realization of interconnectedness and of all living beings, and also described how suffering is created through ignorance and particularly through craving, and which elucidated a path of ethics, of meditation, to develop wisdom into the nature of things. What was missing in that emphasis on the teachings was the example of the Buddha himself, who had spent, subsequent to his awakening about the age of 35, he spent 45 years wandering around northeast India teaching people. And so his actual example was not only of being an awakened one, of being wise, but it was also of compassion for the people he met, of actually, rather than just kind of going off somewhere and retiring, you know, having awakened, retiring quietly somewhere in the forest, he spent 45 years wandering around teaching people and helping people. And there are many lovely examples in the literature of examples of his kindness and of his skill in communicating his teachings to the many people that he met. So the later Buddhist tradition took that, his example, this example of his kindness to all the people that he met, and began to see or to emphasize the importance of compassion and of kindness as the goal of the spiritual life, rather than just the development of wisdom or of understanding. And then it even began to equate the two and say, well, if you have some sort of understanding but without the compassion, then it isn't a full realization. It's not a full awakening. So in that way, as Buddhism has come down to us now in the West, you find there's a great emphasis on compassion, on kindness, particularly in that tradition. And that also finds its way through to the later schools, including, for example, of which the Dalai Lama is a member, sort of Vajrayana Lamaistic Buddhism in Tibet. So that the Dalai Lama will say of Buddhism, my religion is simple, he says, my religion is kindness. And the Dalai Lama himself is considered to be an incarnation of kindness. Yeah. So the Tibetan people sort of look on him as an example of an aspect of the, if you like, of the Buddha's awakened mind, incarnated in human form, just expressing through his acts of body and speech and mind, kindness to all the beings that he encounters. So the Dalai Lama is seen as this example, if you like, in later developed Buddhism, of this combination, if you like, of wisdom, of understanding, and of kindness. And from what I've read of the Dalai Lama and accounts and people who've met him, they always say there's something extraordinary about him, and that he does seem to embody this atmosphere of kindness. So, by the way, the Dalai Lama, sometimes people think the Dalai Lama is a bit like the Pope in Buddhism, yeah? And he's not actually, he's just one of the teachers of a particular school of Buddhism. But nonetheless, I think, you know, if we're wondering about this emphasis on kindness from the Dalai Lama, and we're wondering, well, is that really Buddhist? All I've got to say is, just to say, is the Pope a Catholic? You can just say, well, is the Dalai Lama a Buddhist? I think you can pretty definitely say, yes, the Dalai Lama is a Buddhist. And that way of expressing what the essence of Buddhism is very consistent with the tradition over the last 2,500 years, which expresses this dimension of the Buddha's awakening. Now, I've spoken about the Buddha as the founder of Buddhism 2,500 years ago. And that's one way of speaking about the Buddha as the historical person who started the Buddhist tradition 2,500 years ago. But there's another way of thinking of the Buddha, which is in some ways perhaps more common, and that is to think of the Buddha as a symbol for what human beings can themselves become. So, and this is something that the Buddha himself taught, the historical Buddha taught, that we all had the potential to become awakened just as he had. So the Buddha isn't a god, in a way you could say the Buddha is an example of developed humanity. It's humanity at its highest, you know, having developed understanding, having developed compassion, and manifested that in action, altruistic and kind action towards others over many years. So that's the example of the historical Buddha. But over the years, that example has also found has been an ideal for Buddhists to aspire to be like the historical Buddha, you could say. But it also takes the form of a more mythical, archetypal Buddha, who simply embodies the various human qualities developed to their highest. And this ideal of awakening, of enlightenment, sometimes even becomes a bit detached from the historical Buddha, and it just becomes something that Buddhists aspire to, these qualities of understanding, of energy, of kindness, compassion, and so forth. So that whereas maybe some religious faiths, you know, the truth of the existence of their founder can be very important. Actually, for Buddhists, although the tradition starts with the Buddha, in some ways the historicity of the Buddha, which is very well established through a large body of historical evidence, isn't all that important, because even if the Buddha hadn't existed, for me certainly, I would still have the Buddha as an ideal, if you like. The Buddha, the ideal of awakening, the ideal of developing understanding of kindness, of compassion, of energy, and so forth. Simply because they're noble ideals in themselves. Yeah. So this is one of the ways in which the Buddha is understood by Buddhists these days, is partly as a historical personage who started the tradition, but also as an ideal, as an archetype, as a symbol of what we all can become. So in a sense you could say, we all have the potential for awakening within us. And sometimes it's spoken of, it's as though... I'm trying to think how to say this so it sounds appropriate. It's like we all have Buddhas inside, yeah? And that's covered over by our confusion and our ignorance. But fundamentally, deeper within our nature is this intrinsic kindness, this wisdom, this sense of interconnectedness with others. So this this way of thinking that that there may be this potential for awakening within us is one of the themes of my talk today regarding modes of mind, because it's very easy to think of ourselves as being cruel, as being unkind, as being selfish. And for example, you know, Freud wrote this book, Civilization and Its Discontents, and basically gave a very pessimistic view of human nature, that basically we were fundamentally quite selfish and not very altruistic or concerned with others. Now, in more recent years, that view has been challenged, and it's been seen, you know, that that intrinsic to us is our qualities of altruism, that as a sort of as an evolved social species, you know, with a sort of as mammals, we have this this heritage, you know, we've evolved this heritage of connection with others, of kinship, of friendliness, of emotional warmth, of concern for others, of natural altruism. And so then you get another view, which is that, you know, goodness, kindness is actually intrinsic to us. So you've got the sort of contrasting views. Well, is nature just, you know, we're a product of nature, red in tooth and claw, you know, vicious, nasty, brutish, short, all that sort of thing. That's the life in the natural world. And then on the other hand, you have this view of human beings as intrinsically good and caring and so forth. And I think the answer to that, you know, of which of those is true, is that both of them are true, actually. And that we have the ability to be nasty, to be cruel, and we also have the ability to be warm, kind, caring. And this is where the interest in modes of mind expresses itself for me, is that some of the more recent science of emotions has been exploring the way our minds can operate in two different modes. Yeah, one based on nurture and with a mode of approach, of caring, of kindness, and another based in threat and safety, where we become sort of protective and sometimes hostile in relation to others and aggressive and so on. And the question then becomes, you know, how does one activate, if you like, the mode of mind of caring, of nurture and of compassion, rather than the mode ultimately it's protective, but it can manifest in very destructive ways. So how can one reduce aversion and hatred and increase kindness and well-wishing and love? So another little quote from the Dalai Lama. He says, "Buddhist teachings are not a religion, they're a science of mind." And I thought, you know, seeing as this talk is part of Science Week, I thought that was a stimulating idea. And I think what he's expressing there is that Buddhism, it involves teachings and practices to cultivate the better side of our nature, if you like. And to decrease the aversion, so to increase the kindness, the wisdom, the sense of connectedness with others, and to decrease the aversion, the fear, the anxiety, and so forth, which can manifest themselves in destructive behaviours in relation to ourselves and others, and so easily do. And in some ways, this is what is meant by ignorance. You know, when we speak of awakening and aspiring to awakening, it's awakening from these habits and modes of mind which are restrictive and destructive, and which, in a way, don't do justice to the full range of human potentials which we all have. So I'd like to just explore a little bit now the idea that that, you know, compassion, kindness, etc., is already in us. There's a Chinese philosopher, Mencius, and he makes the point that if one were to see a young child about to fall down a well, you naturally feel concern, and you naturally would save the child. You know, you'd rush to protect it. And he's making that point against the argument that we're selfish and not concerned with others. And he's drawing attention to the fact that we do have this innate capacity to be concerned about others. And he says one doesn't save the child so that people will praise one. Yeah, it's not so that you can feel good about yourself, or so that people will praise you. It's a natural response to that, to the danger that child is in, is that you would naturally express, you'd naturally respond in a caring way. And I think this is probably true for all of us, that you know, if you saw somebody about to, you know, for example, step out into the traffic, you would naturally, you'd naturally express concern. You'd naturally shout or try and pull them back from the traffic. So that caring dimension is there, but then sometimes it becomes obscured by aversion, by hatred, by ill will, and in terms of this recent sort of psychology, it's seen as that aversion and hatred and ill will would be seen as an expression of the mode of mind which is to do with safety and dealing with threat. So the two sides are there in us. We're able to be aggressive and defensive, and to activate a fight or flight type response in response to danger, and that's how we've survived, that's how we've evolved to be as we are, by being capable of aggression, by being capable of defensive behaviour and so forth. But equally, we've evolved to be as we are by having a sort of nurturing, caring, social dimension to our behaviour. And some of the recent science of compassion is examining that sort of evolutionary heritage, and exploring, well, why is kindness, why is caring so important in human behaviour? And it's, you know, it's to do with things like investing so much in developing a relatively small number of offspring who need a lot of caring to develop the large brains that we have relative to other species. And there's a whole vast literature around the nature of, I suppose, of human caring and how that compares with other species. So we have this these sides to our nature, if you like, the side that can lash out, that can be protective in dealing with threat, and we also have the side that can be nurturing and protective in caring for ourselves and others. And what much of Buddhist practice is about cultivating the side to do with care and compassion and with nurture. So one of the ways that this is there's a story of some Native American, and this person was famed for their kindness and their compassion. And somebody said, how come you're like this? You're such a lovely, warm, kind, wise person. How do you come to be like this? And this person said, well, there are two wolves inside, and they're both hungry. One is the wolf of hate, and the other is the wolf of love. And what I do is I do my best to feed the wolf of love. And in that way, it grows stronger, and the other one grows weaker. So that's in symbolic terms, in a way, that's what the path of development of increasing kindness is about. It's about just feeding that ability that's already there, that faculty that's already present in us, and developing it. And I suppose just appreciating that dimension is there is that can be a place to start, is by just reflecting that we do have this concern for ourselves and others, and just to appreciate that we all want to be safe and happy and well. And in fact, even quite a lot of our behaviour is about that. It's about taking care of ourselves, keeping ourselves warm and dry and so on. And we do that all quite naturally, quite unthinkingly. So if it's a bit cold, we put on warmer clothes. If we're hungry, we eat and so forth. And all this is an expression of taking care of ourselves. But equally, sometimes that manifests in consideration to others. As I gave the example earlier, if you saw somebody about to sort of do something dangerous, you know, unwittingly do something dangerous, you might call out a warning or act to help them from getting into trouble. So the path of development in Buddhism is about affirming that side of concern, of interconnectedness with others, of kindness, and manifesting that increasingly in behaviour, in speech, and in understanding. Now, there's a story from another Buddhist teacher called Alan Wallace, which I think illustrates the value of understanding here as well. And he says, imagine you're just coming back from doing some shopping, and you've got a whole load of heavy bags of groceries, and somebody bumps into you, and you go flying, and both of you go flying. And then you just see all the smashed eggs on the ground and all the burst tomatoes and everything, and you get up and you're just so angry, and you just say, what's wrong with you? Are you blind? And then you look at the other person and you realise they are blind. Yeah? And then what happens is that understanding instantly transforms the reaction from one of aggression and of dealing with the situation in an aggressive way to concern for the other person. Oh, are you all right? Yeah. So understanding is one of the elements of compassion. That if one understands that people are to some extent blind and why they're like that, then it becomes less about judging and criticizing, and it becomes more about having sympathy and concern for the others, and indeed for oneself. So one of the benefits of this evolutionary understanding of the modes of mind, the sort of threat safety based mode of mind and the nurturing mode of mind, is that if we do find ourselves acting unkindly or acting on the basis of feeling threatened, instead of giving ourselves a hard time, we can just appreciate, well, that's the way we are. We are all blind to some extent. And yet also that, you know, that system has evolved for quite good reasons. I think the trouble is that in our sort of modern society particularly, that threat-based aspect of ourselves is overstimulated. So we're going around in a quite a lot of the time in the modern Western world in a state of mild anxiety, or sometimes even extreme anxiety. And in that mode of mind, we tend to see threat. We see others as threatening. We see situations as threatening, and also we tend to be see ourselves in a critical, judgmental way. These are all aspects of that mode of mind, which is concerned in dealing with threat. So the task becomes how to soothe that aspect of ourselves and how to increase the kindly aspect. And there are many practices in the Buddhist tradition to do this, simply beginning with ethical practice, just behaving kindly as best one can in lots of situations, speaking kindly, and thinking kindly, having kindly intentions in relation to self and others as best one can. And that would be the basis of Buddhist ethical behaviour. Is basically it's about expressing and manifesting kindness in actions, in speech, and in mental events as best one can. As well as ethics, then, you also get the practice of meditation. These are practices which are to calm the mind, to clarify the mind, and to develop qualities of, for example, as I said, clarity, but also of kindliness. And on the basis of calming and clarifying the mind, it then becomes possible to develop a deeper understanding of ourselves and of the world that we find ourselves in. So this is the traditional path taught by the historical Buddha 2,500 years ago of ethics, meditation, and wisdom. And as I say, it would maybe in later formulations, it would be a path of ethics, meditation, wisdom, and compassion. So the place of meditation then is about developing wisdom and compassion, partly by calming and clarifying the mind, and also by cultivating qualities of kindness, of concern for ourselves and for others. And practically speaking, this will involve recognizing the tendencies that we have, the blindness that we have itself, compassionately, and just allowing ourselves to be as we are, and at the same time still holding to the ideal of feeding, if you like, the wolf of love rather than the wolf of hate. Yeah. So I started off earlier saying that my interest in compassion has been particularly stimulated by increasingly seeing the connection of kindliness and compassion with meditation. And I suppose originally I thought that if one could just calm and clarify one's mind, that then it would become easy to develop wisdom and understanding. And that seemed like something that could be done in relative isolation. You know, sort of imagine the yogi off in the cave meditating and just becoming very calm and clear. And as the years have gone by, I've realized more and more that we are social beings. We are interconnected with other beings. And that idea of just calming, clarifying the mind in isolation, just it isn't real. It isn't the way things are. Yeah, actually, we have this. We live in a network of relationship with others. Even the yogi in the cave has got connections to others. And in fact, there's a famous Tibetan yogi called Milarepa, who's famous for spending years and years in a cave by himself. But actually, if you read the stories of Milarepa, every day he would think of his fellow practitioners, and particularly of his teacher. And it was almost like they were there in the cave with him. Yeah. So the dimension of kindliness, of interconnectedness, of relationship to oneself and to others has started to assume more importance for me in my own practice, but also I've increasingly seen the way in which a lack of kindness hinders the development of a deeper calm and basis for understanding and realization that meditation is intended to develop. So, hence the interest now in compassion, in kindness, and the I suppose the encouragement and stimulation that comes from more recent study in the scientific community into compassion, into kindness, and so forth. So, I can say a little bit more about you know, what compassion and kindness are and aren't. So, in saying that you know, compassion is about relationship, about nurturing, and so forth, that's not to say that it's about you know, chocolate box, fluffy, rose tinted spectacles, that kind of thing. Yeah. It's actually about the ability to maintain that care, that connection, even in the face of difficulty, even in the face of suffering. One of the definitions of compassion is it's kindliness when it meets suffering. Yeah. So when you're in a happy, wholesome state of mind, you're feeling very happy, you're feeling friendly, you're feeling positive, that's a state of loving kindness. And then when that loving kindness meets someone who's suffering, the natural response is compassion. So that's one way to describe what compassion is. It's the response of friendliness, of goodwill when it meets suffering. So the suffering that motivated the Buddha was the suffering of old age, disease and death, these universal features of human life. And that's what started him off on his quest for awakening, his quest for understanding. But more recently, for myself, I've been exploring particularly the way to go deeper in meditation, the relationship of meditation to stress, to distress. I've been particularly, over the last few years, I've been teaching mindfulness-based stress reduction courses. So I've been examining this area of stress and of anxiety and depression and how these manifest in difficulties in taking care of ourselves or of others. And this has led to this interest in these modes of mind and this question of, well, how do you feed the side of kindliness, the side of compassion? And this involves, as I've mentioned already, an understanding that that we have this this certain degree amount of blindness, if you like, that is we've inherited these dimensions of both of nurturing and caring, but also we have this dimension of responding with aversion, with hatred, and so on. And recognizing that this is just part of our human heritage makes it a bit easier to not just be judgmental about them and to, in a way, just to recognize, well, that's the way we are, and let's do our best to develop and feed the side of kindliness. So in early Buddhism, expressed this in some teachings in the Dhammapada, which is an early Buddhist text, and it speaks about this dimension of mind training as a way of moving towards awakening, of developing our full human potential. So it goes like this. This is the first verses from this text, a very early Buddhist text called the Dhammapada. It says, experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with an impure mind, suffering follows, even as the cartwheel follows the hoof of the ox. Experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with a pure mind, happiness follows, like a shadow that never departs. Those who entertain such thoughts as, "He abused me, he beat me, he conquered me, he robbed me," will not still their hatred. Those who entertain such thoughts as, "He abused me, he beat me, he conquered me, he robbed me," will still their hatred. Not by hatred are hatreds ever pacified here in the world. They are pacified by love. This is the eternal law. So, this distinction is being made here, right in early Buddhism, between the two modes. First of all, the attention is drawn to the importance of mind in constructing the world, in creating the reality which we all perceive from day to day. But it's also drawing attention to the way we respond to threat, the way we respond to difficulty. And it's saying, not by hatred are hatreds ever pacified here in the world. They're pacified by love. So right here in early Buddhism, you have this this expression of those two aspects, if you like, the two wolves, and basically an encouragement to feed the wolf of love. Now, one of the this wolf of love, when it meets with suffering, can manifest as compassion, but equally there are what are called far and near enemies to compassion. And the far enemy of compassion would manifest as cruelty or indifference to the suffering of others. The near enemy can be where we aren't quite ready to sort of take on the suffering. So we experience sentimental pity. Oh dear, you know, so somebody describes some painful thing, or we see somebody in a state of suffering, and we just go, "Oh dear, that must be very difficult for you, or very painful." But we don't actually feel their suffering. We don't feel their distress. We kind of keep it at a bit of a distance. That's one way to. That's what's called a near enemy of compassion, is sentimental pity. Another near enemy is horrified anxiety. So this is where we perceive suffering, but rather than maintaining a relationship to that suffering, where we're sensitive to it and we're able to act, which is incidentally the way the Dalai Lama, again, has defined compassion as a sensitivity to suffering and a wholehearted desire to act and to a motivation to respond to that suffering. Rather than it being compassion, it becomes horrified anxiety, which is where we become overwhelmed by the suffering that we experience. And I think one of the dangers, again, of the modern world is that, you know, every day on the news, we're just hearing about human suffering again and again and again. And that can either produce this sort of horrified anxiety, or after a while it just becomes too much and we sort of block off from it and becomes indifference. So to express compassion in our lives, we need to find a balance between being aware of the suffering in the world and at the same time not being overwhelmed by it. So part of the practice of compassion is to take care of oneself and to be kindly to oneself. In fact, that's where it starts. In responding to the suffering, the cries of the world, it's no good if you're feeling sort of anxious and horrified in yourself, or indeed if you're not feeling genuinely moved by it. The compassion involves a wholehearted emotional engagement with what's going on around one. And in this particular case of response to suffering, it involves a recognition and a feeling response to that suffering, but not a response of being overwhelmed by it. So I'm just going to finish with just a little reminder of some of the ground I've covered. So the Buddhist, I suppose I began by describing the Buddha and his concern to respond to the universal suffering in the world, the suffering of old age, disease and death, and how he attained awakening and then spent 45 years teaching people basically how to become free of suffering. Those teachings involve an understanding of the interconnectedness of human life, how we're interconnected with the rest of the universe, actually, not only other living beings, but you know, even of those of you who've seen any of those recent Brian Cox programs on the nature of the universe, you can see we're connected even with the stars. We're actually even made up of stardust and so forth. So there's this interconnectedness with all things. That's very much part of the Buddha's understanding. But also the emotional dimension of that is a feeling of kinship with other living beings and a kindness that the Buddha himself manifested over 45 years of his wandering around Northeast India teaching. And those teachings are sometimes summarized as, the most fundamental summary involves a teaching of interconnectedness, of just showing how we don't actually exist as isolated, separate individuals, but actually we're interconnected with other beings. Clearly, especially other human beings, where we have this, we have this, we've evolved as social beings, but also we're connected, despite the sort of sense the sort of illusions of ego, we're connected intimately with the rest of existence, and as an emotional realization that manifests as friendliness towards. Towards all beings. And in terms of recognizing the sufferings of other beings, it manifests as compassion. Now, that compassion can only manifest in a sort of undistorted way, rather than as one of the near enemies of compassion, when we have compassion for ourselves as well as others. So we need to take care of ourselves as well as others. And the various teachings and practices of the Buddha involve teachings which emphasize the kindliness to ourselves and others in ethical practice. Also meditations to cultivate calm, clarity and kindness. And then meditations practices to cultivate an insight into the interconnectedness of ourselves with others. the practice of compassion is it's a challenging practice, I suppose this is why we're vulnerable to the. To those near enemies of sentimental pity or horrified anxiety, is because being sensitive to suffering, even our own suffering and the suffering of others, takes a certain amount of courage, it takes a certain amount of strength. And one of the reasons why mindfulness practice is so important, or why meditation is so important in developing compassion, is that it gives one an ability to sit with suffering without getting caught up in it, without over-identifying with it, and at the same time without sort of cutting off from it. There's a meditation, famous Burmese meditation teacher called Ajahn Chah, and he describes meditating and sort of observing the patterns of mind and the play of the mind that tends to arise in meditation, he describes it as sitting like, as though you're sitting by a clear forest pool, and you're just sitting quietly, observing the various animals coming to drink, the various wild animals. And sometimes these animals can be quite scary, yeah? But one is just sitting quietly, observing. And in this way, the dimension of calm, of settling that comes through mindfulness meditation can help one to see the various emotional reactions that arise and at the same time maintain a care and a concern, but without getting overwhelmed. So just to be sensitive to it, but without getting either... whether you're either blocking away from it or getting overwhelmed by it. So I'm just going to finish with a poem by a modern poet called Naomi Shihab Nye. And this describes the importance of recognizing suffering as we you know, find it in the world. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. Only kindness that ties your shoes and sends out into the day to mail letters and purchase bread. Only kindness that rises its head from the crowd of the world to say, "It is I you have been looking for," and then goes with you everywhere, like a shadow or a friend. Thank you.